Thank you, Dr. Mulder. I appreciate very much the invitation to develop this presentation. In the letter of invitation, he suggested that I present something about what is now known that we didn't know before we started electron microscopy. I've tried to reflect that in various ways. Advances in electron microscopy for use in soils over the last few decades have included several things, such as the early instruments had rather low voltage, and that was okay for the biological community where most of the microscopes were used, first off. But now most of the work, at least what we do, is a 200 kV instrument, which for the iron and manganese compounds and other heavier elements, that's a distinct advantage. Of course, digital acquisition instead of film is a big step forward. Fast Fourier transform is also a convenient aspect of a modern transmission electron microscope, because astigmatism, it takes a lot of time and sometimes we misjudge it. But we've got it now in a more mathematical treatment and more convenient to use. The energy dispersive spectroscopy coming on stream for both SEM, scanning electron microscopy, as well as transmission electron microscopy is, of course, very important to supplement our morphological data with various chemical data. This is particularly helpful to pick up some rare earth elements that we might miss by ordinary methods, and serve sort of as an indicator within a given suite of samples. Improved target materials, the Lab 6 lanthanum hexafluoride has given us a good steady performing instrument now for a few decades, I think. And so that's what we rely on to get the electron beam, although we have to tenderly take care of it. I looked at a few benchmarks when the question came up, well, what do we know today that we didn't know before? I took down my old Soils Yearbook of Agriculture, 1957, and they listed several layered silicate minerals, but they didn't even mention iron oxides. So I assume that they didn't have much information at that point. Some 20 years later, Shortman and Taylor put together a very nice chapter on iron oxides in the 77th issue of Minerals and Soil Environments. And then the same authors, about a decade later, brought more data, and they included lattice fringes in their diagnostic criteria. So there are steps, improvements in the instrumentation and in the skills of the operators. The two references at the bottom, Seskus and Lynn and Grossman, both came out in the same journal issue of Soil Science Society America Journal with the SEM data. So SEM just came on to the practical world at that time, but of course it being rather user-friendly came into use right away, and to wider use as it advanced. The early SEMs didn't have chemistry, but that wasn't long in coming. The thing that I appreciate about electron microscopy, and I've learned it once again in the past year, it fits very well with step-by-step learning, which you all are familiar with, observations, establishing a hypothesis, and then data acquisition and interpretation, and then improving the hypothesis, and more data and conclusions. And I think that's what most of us want to accomplish. And a TEM really works nice in that format, and SEM also. The That's the same. I think I went the wrong way. Thank you. I'll just give you some examples. Iron oxides. In the spring, the rice paddies, when they're turned with a plow, are basically gray in the Beaumont clay, Fertisol of southeast Texas. But within a matter of weeks, we begin to see red, which is the ferry hydrite, the granular stuff, and then there's some yellowing, and that's the lath shaped. That's the lepidocrosite. And although the structures, and eventually some goethite is beginning to show itself. Well, this is crystal growth right at the very beginning, going on in a short interval of time. And we need very special methods to deal with that. Now, ferry hydride structure is reasonably well known. Even within the last 2 years, there's been a new revision for the structure. So while it does have structure, it's difficult to define. The lepidocrosite has a structure in Dr. Ding's model here of these octahedral, and it is a quick former, and like other quick forming minerals, it's not perfect when it forms. In this set of examples, this is what I call a free-form goethite aggregate, which formed in a vertisol. But in older goethites, which even where we have lattice fringes, it's that we can be that specific, and we can see the lattice fringes in numerous places here. Well, the maturity and the history of those certainly tells us something about soils. Now, take this one, for example. I think of it as a sort of twin with four different arms, and the electron diffraction pattern is evident there. But obviously, if this crystal had been transported down a stream, it might look more like this crystal. So there's a lot of information there. And, of course, the age of these two might be quite different. Totorokite is a Japanese term. It was discovered in a mine in Japan. And it came on the screen when oceanography was looking at manganese oxides in a professional way. And a Swiss chemist was quite an expert on manganese oxides. And he's tried to analyze some totorokite, and he wasn't happy with his results. So he concluded that maybe totorokite should be reevaluated. Well, as it happened in 82, I was at Arizona State University, and Turner and Busick were there, and they began to show me data like this for totorokite, the twinning, the 1 nanometer twins. And later, from a colleague who's studying soils in Central America, he brought me this vertisol, this example, and he brought me some nodules, and I analyzed them, he and I, and this is the twinning of the best soil totorokite I've ever seen. Now you might well imagine that all totorokite is not the same. Well, that's what Turner and Busick showed. They showed that, well, they're supposed to be three if it is a perfect crystal. Well, then X-ray diffraction would respond well. But this is a very unfaithful kind of a mineral. They may be four octahedral wide or five octahedral, or maybe in a few cases, two. Well, so that's probably one reason our colleague in chemistry from Switzerland was confused, because he probably got some bad totorokite. And what Turner and Busick were studying was probably a better sample. So to kind of look at the whole of manganese oxide, since they've been slow to come on the stream, Golden was struggling to find some good examples of bernicite in soils, but we didn't find them. And so, being an incisive mind that he is, he took some solution with manganese in solution and put in some soil microorganisms from our microbiologist colleague, and grew this bernicite. Well, now that you see that specimen grown in solution, I think you can see why it's a challenge to identify bernicite in soils, because it doesn't take on the distinctness that you normally associate with crystals. Totorokite, on the other hand, on the outside of siderite boulders, a key element in our reclamation of lignite spoil in Texas, makes some nice fibers seen by scanning electron microscopy. But then, coming from soils, there is totorokite, but it's a sorry example of the way twinning is, but yet you can see the angles. Golden also became interested in lithium fluoride. Well, lithium fluoride is not an honest manganese oxide entirely, because it has a lot of aluminum in it as well as a little lithium. But it grows well in nodules from this oxisol in Hawaii. And so it was once identified morphologically as kaolinite, but yet that is lithium fluoride. And it has, of course, aluminum and lithium and manganese in this layer structure. SEM, scanning electron microscopy, is a good way of looking at something that's complex, such as soil nodules. And you can see the iron concentration is quite abundant here, but likewise on the opposite quadrant here, manganese is deficient. And also, where manganese is up, iron is down. So it's a good instrument to give us data when we can't completely give the mineralogical analysis that we would like to. We have in Texas and many other soils, I suspect that some of you have encountered, have opal CT. Well, now this is another mineral that's not so faithful. It's not a single crystal phase, but it's opaline material plus cristobalite and tritomite. And Senkai, in a study in reclamation material, found a petrified log about 2 meters below the soil surface in College Station, Texas. And he examined it and some good specimens and got some very nice little platy particles as well as some much coarser quartz. So we have to supplement our science with sometimes a little geology to move along. Well, 6 years ago, we became interested in the mineral, the mycotoxin, aflatoxin. And in order to determine aflatoxin, we've looked at quite a few bentonites, about 20, and they're quite diverse. There's about a tenfold difference in their ability to adsorb. And we did not understand that until the last year, and I think we understand it much better now, and that's what I want to show you. This happens to be 5 bentonites from Texas. The top 2 are the better. But the main point of this is, when we see a continuum of particle size, I think we'd fairly say that those particles in the coarse clay and in the fine silt are surely important to the mass action reactions, because that's where most of the particles are in these bentonites. And with using a cartoon-like model of smectite layer and then for the organic molecule, and ignoring the cation exchange ions and the water molecules, we found in the first year of our research, I think, that Kanewischer published that, in fact, these organic molecules did move in between the layers, and that was shown very nicely, and they resisted collapse once they were there. Well, this past summer, we got our heads together, and I'll tell you what that means in a moment. Began to look at some very nice model bentonites, from one from Arkansas, one from from Oklahoma. And the cation exchange of these is something like 100. And here are two of our Texas ones. They've got high CEC, but not quite that high. And but notice the massiveness here of these. And then notice the translucency up here and even some porosity within the aggregate. And over here, you can see a lot of folding around the edges and then the massiveness part of it, but still a lot of thin edge. And then there's a thin, relatively separate plate there. These surely have much more surface area for adsorbing than do these. Well, we went then to thinking about the finer points, and so we pursued lattice fringes. And here in this 4TX, notice the fraying of the edges and this whole layer. See, when these smectites bend, some of that structure is vertical and near parallel to the electron beam. And therefore, we can image and thereby tell the thickness of that plate, which is something like 5 to 10. That's a 1 nanometer spacing we're looking at there. And then over here, and this other one, you see it's lath-like edges and frayed and even one or two layers thick in some places. Well, these are high-absorbing smectites. And no surprise, they're very accessible. Now, turning to the Arizona and the Oklahoma case, yes, they have some fringes, but not representing very much of the sample. Most of it is massive like this, and the surface area from the aflatoxin perspective is not very effective. And the same thing for this massive Oklahoma example, which does have some fringes on the edges. So from that, we think that we have good reason to say that the crystallinity and the thickness and the elasticity and the curvature of the smectite influences it a whole lot as an adsorbent. Well, the Japanese have younger soils formed that never dry, and of course they have some amorphous material, as we once called it. But then with electron microscope, we could see something for the emogolite, these fibrous particles with fringes, and then the circular aliphatic materials that were grouped together for a long time. When I was a grad student, they were grouped together. And then later, through electron microscopy and other methods, we were able to get more information. Well, again, Dr. Ding's been drawing some models, and these are very nice. And they give us a much better interpretation. Wada worked out his structural model based on electron diffraction as well as morphology. And they serve as a basis for this image. And let's turn now to a totally different mineral. In our reclamation work, and many of you in soils work, this is from the Aubrey soil, which is North Texas soils. And you can see right away some cubic evidence here, and then perhaps some octahedral symmetry there. And you might say, well, this is the shape of pyrite. Well, of course it is the shape of pyrite, but it's actually jarosite. So it is with soils. We have to be multitaskers to be effective in identifying and characterizing. But of course, it's important because jarosite is a distinctively yellow-colored mineral, and it forms at a pH of about 3. So whenever we find jarosite, we have a lot of information about the history of the soil and its history of pH. Well, electron microscopy is special contributions to soil science, detecting trace elements by EDS, unique shape of minerals and how they form. We were studying halloysite, and the geologist said, well, we can't explain why colloidite could be in spherical form. But we happen to be also studying some volcanic material from Mexico, and we found the colloidite forming in the vesicules, in the bubbles in the glass. So that's a pretty good hypothesis, we think. The crystallinity of iron oxides changes seasonally, and the phosphate chemistry of the soil changes. Well, whenever the soil dries out and crystal growth occurs seasonally, that ties up the phosphate. But then, whenever the flood is on the rice paddy, the phosphate is released. So the soil test had to be redesigned with that in mind. Well, we need to keep these in mind when we consider our methodology. We need to share our skills with colleagues and engineers and open new developments for electronics, which we are good users of. This is where I work. This is the instrument that I use and I teach in Dr. Dream's soil mineralogy class at the present time. And it has on the right here a computer which instead of the film that used to be used, we use for the electronic, the digital camera analysis. And then on the left, it has EDS. It's not shown. And if you're working with nanoparticles, here's a newer TEM, which I haven't used, but it is being used for like heavy metals and some Gulf materials. And here is an SEM, also being used for very small particles of catalysts. And for my colleagues who work with cereal, like for tortillas and such, this is a SEM also. And it has the ability to look at a sample cold or warm or even cook it some degree. So we work best as a team, and I think that's the way Anna is one of our strong graduate students, is one of our great assists. Peter Busek was my host when I was at Arizona State in 82. And I thank him. And that's a good place to learn electron microscopy. I spent a sabbatical there. And Dr. Ding has been most helpful in numerous ways. Ziping Liu is an engineer, a doctor's degree in engineering. And he's at our center. And he was helpful in my getting retuned to the microscope. And whenever I got in trouble, he saved me lots of hours and helped me get the job done. And then we have to have another postdoc who helps keep us in line and editing manuscripts and lab ideas too. And so I appreciate this opportunity to visit with you today. Thank you.
Questions for Dr. Dixon. Yeah, Michael. This doesn't have to do with transmission electron microscopy, but I'm really interested in tortorokite and how prevalent it might be in soils. What kind of sodium levels in the soil might be required to support tortorokite?
Well,
should I expect to find it routinely? I guess is what
I'm thinking. That's a good question. Tortorokite, just to sort of recap where we've seen it do best, in the Verdesol, which was near the Guatemalan border in South America, I would say we'd look to see what the pH of that is, and probably it's not too low. I would say it's probably intermediate, and I would, because it forms on the surface of weathering siderite boulders, which siderite of course is a carbonate, that seems to say something about a moderate pH. And the fact that in our soils, when I encounter tortorokite, which is, you know, it's like a ghost, you see very little of it. But you can see it occasionally because it's distinctive, you know. The 1 nanometer fringes, they look like railroad tracks on a high resolution line microscope sometimes. And I would say in acid soils, it's on the way out. It's dissolving, probably. So I would look for between a pH of 6.5 and 7 or above. Just from a practical
view. Another one? Yes, Mike.
So the absorption of aflatoxins, is it driven more by the surface area or CEC? You know, you showed the different bentonites, and it looked like, you know, surface area is driving more.
I think surface area is the more important of the two. But obviously it's smectite, and it has a high CEC. We, in our published description, we say 70 CEC or more for bentonite. One of the real intriguing things to us is that when we read the literature, even in Webster's dictionary, bentonite was used as a medical amendment. And in the literature about it, it's called a clay rock. But as you can see from our data, it's as much a silt rock as it is a clay rock, maybe more. And I think for these molecules, it doesn't need to be too highly charged. And thinking back, we published a paper from Auburn University years ago where we were studying a pesticide, dockwater paraquat. And North Carolina's worked in this area too. And we stated then that, and from some of my work on the doctor's degree in Wisconsin, that ions can move in and out of restricted interlayers, but molecules cannot always do that, organic molecules. And that certainly is true of our aflatoxins. Aflatoxins is not a big molecule, you know, it's five carbon ring structures, and they got five double bonded oxygens around them to enter into bonding. And from there, I turn it over to Dr. Dean. He's the bonding person. Yes.
Dr. Dixon, I was curious as a follow-up, what the sites of substitution, were these more octahedrally substituted clays or tetrahedrally substituted clays, and whether that made a difference in aflatoxin uptake?
Well, that's a good subject for research, I'd say. I don't know the answer. But I'm guessing that octahedral is better. Because accessibility is a factor there. And I believe you'll find, and I think you can get a better answer on that if you just look at the literature on this Arkansas and this Oklahoma bentonite. They're model bentonites. But they're not the same model as a lot of other bentonites. There's more diversity there than we usually say when we introduce people to them. So that's I would think, and these are, by the way, are calcium saturated bentonites. The sodium saturated ones don't perform so well. And if you look at the data on published literature on dealing with aflatoxin, I think you'll find it rather consistent there. Prefer calcium, and they'll state it in the description, calcium.
Well, in those images that you showed, showing different densities and porosity and flexibility of two bentonites, or more than two, I guess, how much of that is related to the iron content of the bentonites? It seems to me like the more iron there is, there's going to be more rigidity.
Well, you're right. We use infrared quite a lot. You know, no one instrument was going to keep a clay mineralogist employed. We all need multi-instruments, either our own or our friends. And you pointed out.
The iron in the smectite, so I haven't done that.
In our looking, and in our published description of the best adsorbents, we have four papers on that. The iron shows up in the best ones. It's infrared. If anybody wants to contribute to soil science, they need to help us get infrared that gives us better quality data on clays. We get useful data, but it is not nearly as good. We need a revolution in infrared for clays, just like the X-ray diffraction Dr. Dean talked about. But when we see the iron in a bentonite, it's one of our best performers. That's it.